This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're underfunding these programs to such a dramatic extent when you look at a lot of Western Europe where there's not really a problem with homelessness because they know, you know, like we do in this country, that homelessness is very expensive. It's much more expensive to leave somebody on the streets than it is to find them housing, but we just pay for it out of 10 different pockets.
For the past year and a half, we've been watching the numbers. COVID cases, ER beds, deaths, and more recently, immunization rates. There's another set of numbers, however, that's gotten less attention but is just as connected to this pandemic as any of these other figures. Housing. The pandemic has been a huge test for our nation's ability to house its residents, and so far, we're failing miserably. Experts estimate that 40 million Americans are vulnerable to losing their housing. The federal moratorium on evictions was lifted by the Supreme Court in September, and the vast majority of states have no protections in place to help people hold on to their homes. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Seamus Roller, the executive director of the National Housing Law Project, about housing challenges, evictions, and homelessness. We also discuss potential solutions to advance housing justice. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend and neighbor, Seamus Roller. He's the executive director of the National Housing Law Project. Seamus, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here with you, Alex.
So explain the mission of your organization, the National Housing Law Project.
We're a national legal and advocacy support center, so we help legal aid attorneys and other advocates around the country do housing law, protect tenants, protect low-income homeowners, and then we do a fair amount of advocacy at the federal level around housing law.
What stimulated your interest in the issue of housing?
Well, I started my career working on doing direct street outreach with homeless youth and adults. And so I was doing work on the streets, helping people find access to services, get basic first aid. So I really understood kind of how do you end up being homeless and what are the barriers to getting off the streets? What are the things that happen to people that result in them being homeless? And so I really wanted to think about how do you deal with the upstream problems? And I went to law school and I've been working on housing for my entire career.
Before we dive into some of the solutions, let's outline some of the problems that you and your colleagues at the National Housing Law Project handle on a daily basis. First, let's talk about evictions, because I imagine that is a pretty big palette to work with right there.
Yeah, that's been a lot of COVID in particular. The last 18 months of my life has been thinking about how do evictions play into the COVID pandemic that we're in right now. So there's quite a bit of very good data at this point showing that the higher levels of evictions your community have, the higher level of COVID transmission you have, because the result of eviction is almost always that you move into substandard housing or you move into doubled up conditions where you're around more people, where there's higher likelihood of transmission of COVID. And the longer term effects of evictions can be homelessness as well for part of the population. So I've been working so much on how emergency rental assistance works, some of the federal funding programs that are helping people prevent evictions to pay back the rent that they owe to their landlords and to stay housed in this difficult time.
My family and I went to the Tenement Museum in New York City over the summer and saw how people lived at the turn of the 19th century in these slums for the working poor, the immigrant population of New York generally. I didn't realize that the rents in a lot of these very low-income areas were just as high, if not higher, than standard rental or non-ghettoized, if you will, housing at the time because of redlining. This was just the people had no other options. And so the business proposition for the slum landlord, the slumlord, was just to churn through as many tenants as you could. Just if they were behind in their rent, then they didn't have to pay. Then the landlord didn't have to fix stuff. And so we're in a different age now where people can't explicitly be discriminated against in terms of their housing.
But a lot of the same business practices are alive, aren't they?
If you look back at some of the segregation throughout the United States, what you'll find is predominantly African-American communities, the rent levels were oftentimes higher because the areas of a city that they could live in were so small in comparison. And that meant that the rent levels tended to go up. You look at oftentimes the bigger houses have been segmented into apartments, not because the families couldn't afford to rent a house. It was because the rents were so high in those neighborhoods. And you find this, I think, plays out to this day, that a lot of the housing problems that we have segregation at their base, in which, you know, what was once racial segregation is now, well, we're not going to allow apartment buildings to be built. We're going to have requirements that you have to have a quarter acre of property around your house in order to build it. We're going to prevent duplexes. We're going to do all these things to make sure that no one who's a working class or poor can live in the communities. And so that underlies, I think, a huge part of what we're dealing with in the housing crisis in the United States.
And one thing that I don't think a lot of people think of is the trickle-down effect of an eviction in a community. Maybe speak to the exponential effect that kicking one family out of one unit has on many, many people around that same neighborhood. We think of it as that person couldn't afford it, so they're gone. But it's not so simple, is it?
It's not so simple. I think first it's important to think about, you know, that also that people are getting kicked out for not that much money, right? Which is that oftentimes an eviction is over less than $1,000 across the country. In many cases, that's the majority of evictions in many jurisdictions. So it's a small amount of money, but that eviction, if you know, the demographic factor that most likely predicts that you're going to be evicted is that you have small children. And so that means that your kids are going to have to find a new school system often. It means that you're going to live in an overcrowded condition. You're going to move in with family or friends. There are higher rates of suicide, higher mental health related issues after evictions. COVID has so clearly demonstrated that link between eviction and poor health outcomes. And so what we're doing is spinning a family kind of into this time of uncertainty, of instability for that eviction. And I guess my public policy urge is that fixing that problem is pretty inexpensive in comparison to other public policy interventions that we do, that we can protect the stability of families and of individuals by stopping evictions, which is this moment that creates huge instability in their lives.
Maybe you can speak to some of the work that your organization does and how state, local, and national policies inform your work in terms of the eviction issue alone.
Yeah, so one that we work on is that so many tenants are unrepresented in eviction court. Oftentimes an eviction court hearing will be seconds long. People will get evicted in such a short period of time. So we really push for access to a lawyer during that proceeding is really important. And you have access to counsel in San Francisco, but overall the estimation is about 3% of tenants facing an eviction are represented by an attorney, while over 80% of all landlords are represented. But also that the eviction process is the fastest civil procedure. It happens so quickly. It's not how you imagine if you watch Law and Order how it proceeds. You know, one, you probably don't have a lawyer. You don't get to present evidence. You oftentimes don't really get to question the landlord over what you're getting evicted around. It's just a very fast process. It's designed really to evict people, not to adjudicate the differences between two parties. And so we think about, like, how do you change that dynamic a little bit? How do you make sure that you have a basic level of due process? And some of that is, well, you know, how quickly can a landlord start an eviction proceeding around you? How quickly does that process happen? But also then how do we make sure that tenants get access to rental assistance money if they hit a bump in the road? How do we ensure that there's affordable housing overall?
So if you can kind of cut a swath through a few different states that you do work in, go from the deep south, a very red state where there may not have a lot of tenant protections built in on a state level, and how those tenants might fare versus somebody who lives in, let's say, San Francisco with a more progressive state and local government, And then, is there anything that the federal government can do on these in terms of protecting people from evictions?
In most states in this country, you could be sexually harassed by your landlord. They could evict you for no reason, and then they could steal your security deposit, and there's almost nothing you could do about it. That's the state of how landlord-tenant law works in most of the country. We were working on a case in Virginia where we had a landlord that was renting predominantly to African-American women and racially and sexually harassing them. And we just really dug through the law to try and figure out how do we hold this guy accountable? And there was nothing that we could find that we felt like we could bring a case together on. I mean, that's the sort of state of things for many renters around this country.
Was that problem with Virginia state law in particular, or was that more endemic of just an overarching policy in this country?
No, it's really endemic of overarching policy in the United States about how we handle things in eviction court and housing court. It's just that, it's really tilted in favor of the landlords and this idea that, that they get to do what they want within that property. And I just don't think that balance is really skewed in favor of landlords and doesn't serve us as a country anymore in thinking about how to do housing policy. And you find places like Oregon, which have really reformed their laws and have much stronger protections for tenants. And I think that's where the rest of the country needs to go. In San Francisco as well, San Francisco has rent control. It has just cause. Just cause means that the landlord has to have a reason to evict you. And I think you'd find some people that were frustrated, certainly landlords who are frustrated around the way San Francisco works. But the idea that tenants might have some level of security and some idea about what their rent is going to be, and they know they're not going to be evicted for no reason, I think that's a place we need to be as a country for renters and for the economy to function in the way that it should, given the challenges that we face.
There's been some hard feelings here about some words that were said. Hard feelings and what is wrong. There was a bloody purple nose and some bloody purple clothes that were messing up the lobby floor. It's just apartment house rules, so all you apartment house fools, remember one man's ceiling is another man's floor. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. There's been some strange goings on, and some folks have
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the Executive Director of the National Housing Law Project, Seamus Roller. So, Seamus, give us a snapshot of some of the more popular policies that you and your colleagues see going through state by state to protect tenants from eviction and some of the flaws in these so-called solutions. Where are we falling short? There could be some very well-meaning policymakers who are out there getting behind policy that clearly is not putting us on the path forward.
One of the areas that we work on quite a bit is nuisance and crime-free ordinances. And what those are is you might have a small city, and you see this in rural areas quite a bit, where they require landlords to evict people, or they will fine them if there are too many 911 calls or if there are reports of criminal activity on the property. And what that results in practice is often that you know, you have domestic violence survivors who are calling 911 for help who get evicted from their apartments. You see people who are victims of crimes being evicted because they are being targeted by somebody. And you see real discrimination in some of the crime-free ordinances where they prevent landlords from renting to people who have criminal histories of any kind, though that then has huge sort of racial implications. And there's not a lot of data that says that somebody with a criminal record is in any worse tenant than I am, for that matter. And so those, I think, are some of the ways. And often those ordinances are really used in communities that have other racist policies as well. And they're used as a way to keep African Americans in particular out of those communities. And so there's a huge amount of sort of those crime-free and nuisance ordinances around the country that are having this effect of really undermining stability of families.
What are some of the solutions that your organization is advocating for? And maybe if you can point to some of the countries that are doing it better than the United States in housing their citizens in a safe, humane fashion.
Well, I think there's interesting stuff going on at the federal government right now. You've got this reconciliation infrastructure package, and that has close to, the $300 billion perhaps in it for housing. And so the federal government has stepped out of the housing market in many ways compared to the 1970s. And that's part of the reason why we have homelessness in this country. We sort of imagine that homelessness is not a solvable problem, but it really only existed in the form of modern homelessness since the 70s, since we disinvested in federal housing programs and we kind of failed at our effort to do community-based treatment for people with mental health issues. And those sort of two things combined created the problem that we're dealing with across the country. So we need the federal government to step back in, but we also need to pay attention to the legal conditions of which people are tenants and people are homeowners. And I think that requires, that's a lot of what we work on as an organization. So rental assistance, investments in federal housing, but also we need to reform eviction courts, which are, and the underlying law, which are really, I think anybody who looked at them would be surprised that something like that exists still in the United States.
And maybe you can speak to some of the issues of the intersection between climate change and homelessness that come across your desk on a daily basis now, I imagine.
I think most of your listeners would tend to think about eviction as primarily an issue that affects poor people. But I want to think of evictions and the landlord-tenant law underlying it as something that affects all of us. And that at different points in our lives, we're many of us, almost all of us, are renters, and some of us will be homeowners. But if we really want people to move into cities, many of those people have got to be renters. Being a renter has got to be a better thing. It's got to be something more desirable in order for cities to grow in which the way we need them to too. And part of that is reforming landlord-tenant law. The thing that is a bummer about being a renter is that you don't know when your rent's going to go up. And you know that you can be displaced by your landlord for basically any reason. And we need to change that so that renting has more stability to it. And that benefits all of us. It benefits the economy. But it's really crucial, I think, to meet our sustainability goals and to make cities more livable places to be.
And just from a utility standpoint, I imagine there's a lot of opportunity in terms of infrastructure and in getting more cooperative solar installations so that multi-dwelling units have clean, affordable energy. Utility bills are not an insignificant issue for a lot of these people facing eviction, I imagine.
Yeah, people get evicted all the time for, they're always balancing that rent payment and the utility payment. It's less of a problem here in San Francisco where the weather's nice all the time, but if you're in a very hot place, you're in a very cold place, your utility bills can be, 50% of what your rent is. And so that combination is a difficult one. And doing solar, doing energy efficiency is much easier to do in a multifamily development, right? If you've got 20 units or 60 units or 100 units, it's much easier to do solar and to manage those improvements. You're also just using so much less energy. If you're sharing those walls with somebody else, the efficiency level and the sort of climate change reduction that you get from moving into into a city is pretty high overall. It's not just one thing, but to help make cities more desirable is a crucial piece to all of this.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Seamus Roller. He's the executive director of the National Housing Law Project. So, Seamus, we were talking about evictions earlier. We haven't really addressed the landlords, and they're not only predatory. There are a lot of good landlords out there, and they also hold a lot of important lobbying power in this country. What are some of the problems that landlords face in the current environment, and what are some of the solutions that you see in helping them along with the tenants?
COVID has really revealed how many good landlords there are out there. I mean, the reason we're not facing so many evictions is certainly in part to the fact that there are many, especially small landlords, that have been working with their tenants, that have been forgiving rent, that have been working out repayment plans. And that's been crucial to protecting all of us in the midst of the pandemic. One of the challenges that we see moving forward is just the corporatization of the real estate market. You have real estate investment trusts, you have huge groups like BlackRock who've been moving into the residential real estate market. And what they have tried to do in many cases is squeeze whatever extra dollars there are out of that process. And so part of that is lower staffing levels. Sometimes that is trying to, simplify the property management. One of the ways that they simplify property management is they just have a thing. We file an eviction lawsuit every time somebody's 5 days late on rent or whatever their process is that's resulting in really bad outcomes around evictions and just bad outcomes for tenants as a whole in many of those properties. And the other thing that you see across the country is that the eviction courts are oftentimes filled with evictions from a handful of landlords, that most landlords don't file very many evictions. And then there is a small percentage of the landlord community which files evictions all the time. And sometimes they file what are called serial evictions, in which they are essentially using the eviction courts as a way to get tenants to pay the money that they owe. So they're just filing eviction after eviction against a single tenant.
And what's the best way to combat these abusive landlords and their practices in terms of policy?
One, you need to slow down the process a little bit, and you need to make it more expensive for landlords to file evictions. But you also need, what we have now is an emergency rental assistance program at the national level that is had some real challenges in getting up and started during COVID. But ideally, the way that works is it's there to help tenants who, can't make that half a month's rent that they're behind on. And that's going to help landlords as well. Emergency rental assistance, because evicting a tenant, having an apartment that sits empty is an expensive proposition for landlords. And I think that there's a way to reduce evictions, to give tenants better due process in that system, but also that's going to make more money for landlords over the long term. And I think that's the grand bargain that we've got to strike in this country around this, which is that, renting needs to be a better proposition for tenants, and we can make sure that landlords do just fine as part of it.
Speaking towards the emergency efforts that the government is taking, both the state and federal level during the pandemic, how can federal lawmakers or people in charge of government assistance programs on a state level as well, how can they work with the most needy and vulnerable populations better to try to communicate and allow them to kind of budget some of these potential credits and assistance programs? Like, it must be hard to access them, especially when a lot of them don't have access to the internet.
So the biggest housing program at the national level is the Housing Choice Voucher Program, previously called the Section 8 Voucher Program. And that program serves about one quarter of the people nationally who are eligible for it. And in big cities in particular, the waiting list to get a voucher can be 10 years.
What does the voucher entail, and that it would take longer to get this voucher than to become a U.S. citizen?
So what the voucher is, you know, it essentially, when you have a housing choice voucher, you can go to any landlord that'll take it, and you're going to pay one third of what your income is in rent, and the federal government's going to make up the rest of it. You know, vouchers are a great solution for people who are really on that edge, right? Who are really struggling and are struggling on a regular basis, right? To help them make sure that they can make their rent every month. And it's a great program, but it's so oversubscribed that you know, it can take 8 years, 10 years to get a voucher. And in some places, because of preferences, if you don't fit in one of the preferences, you're probably never going to get off that waiting list.
So obviously, the idea for renters of this voucher is a popular one, too popular. Should we just subsidize it more, or is a different way to skin this cat?
I mean, if I were to offer you up, like, how are we going to solve the housing problem in the United States? I mean, one is the federal government's got to be a bigger player. The vouchers is one way, or other federal subsidies around housing programs. You know, two, you got to undermine the challenges around getting housing built at the local level, and the sort of racist zoning practices that we have across the country has got to be part of this. Three, you've got to reform landlord-tenant law so it protects renters a little bit better than it does right now. Is got to be a piece of how that works in practice. But I think really, from the federal government standpoint, money is a huge piece, because the budget of HUD was so much higher in the 70s, you know, accounting for inflation. And, you know, we're underfunding these programs to such a dramatic extent when you look at a lot of Western Europe, where there's not really a problem with homelessness, because they know, you know, like we do in this country, that homelessness is very expensive. It's much more expensive to leave somebody on the streets than it is to find them housing. But we just pay for it out of 10 different pockets. We have a little bit from healthcare, a little bit from social services, you know, a little bit from the state, a little bit from local government, a little bit in policing, that we don't really take into consideration how expensive that end outcome really is for us.
And how can listeners help the National Housing Law Project in its efforts?
Well, one, I mean, I think reaching out to Congress right now and talking about the importance of investing in housing is the first thing I'd love for you all to do. We'll happily take your donations, but I'd love for you to get more involved in local advocacy around housing policy, around supporting low-income renters, and also to make sure that we challenge some of the, you know, those policies that are creating more segregation in our country, because that's also underneath so much of this is a history of racism and segregation that's underlying the policies that are really now hurting all of us and creating the high housing costs that we're dealing with.
Seamus Roller is the executive director of the National Housing Law Project. Seamus, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Larry Coryell, Paul Simon, and Greg Allman.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week, as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.